The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 134, Masters of the Universe, The Struggle to Control BYU Student Newspaper, by Brian Cagle, and Grooming Students, The Development and Meaning of BYU's Honor Code and Dress and Grooming Standards, by Brian Waterman.
Well, I guess we should get started. I'd like to welcome you to the 134th session here at Sunstone. Can you hear me in the back? Is that better? Well, our two speakers today, Brian Cagle and Brian Waterman, both have experiences with publishing at BYU. Brian Waterman was the editor and publisher for a while of the Student Review, and Brian Cagle was the former editor of the Daily Universe, interestingly enough, both in the 93-94 school year, where they were sort of on opposite sides of the barrier there at BYU. Brian got his BA in communications from BYU. He's now working as an Associated Press stringer. He's the managing editor of Sunstone. He's married to Heather. They have one kid, Mitchell. Brian Waterman is living in, what did I say? Brian Cagle and Brian Waterman. For those of you, yeah. Brian Waterman is living in Boston, Massachusetts. He's a PhD student at Boston University. His wife, Stephanie, and he have one and eight-ninths daughters, Anna and Molly. And Brian?
I need to say at the beginning of this that both Brian and I are deeply indebted to Gary Bergera and Ronald Prittis for the work that they did on their book, Brigham Young University, House of Faith. They have made accessible to us all of their source materials and notes, and this is Gary right here. So anyway, we're glad. This paper has two parts. It is one part historical sketch and another part personal rumination. I was a reporter and editor, as Jeremy mentioned, for the Daily Universe from 1992 to 1995. Keeping that in mind, let me start with a story. This is a true story. I'd recently been promoted to Daily Universe, to a Daily Universe senior reporter. I had taken a job formerly occupied by Jeff Thatcher. He was one of my good friends and a mentor. Jeff had ascended the ranks at the Universe from reporter to desk editor to editor-in-chief and was then a part-time reporter for the Associated Press. He was in charge of covering BYU, and I was impressed. Jeff had hit the big time, and I wanted nothing worse than to scoop him, or at the very least, not be scooped. One afternoon over lunch, the two of us were hanging out, and he disclosed to me that he had just filed a story for the next day's papers. He had discovered that the BYU administration had recently pulled from the library a thick, well-balanced file on evolution, a reference file for students, and they had replaced it with a thin one that contained only official church statements. Jeff, who loved to play the professor, explained to me that this was just another battle in the storied and continued war between the religious education creationists and the BYU scientists and the BYU sciences evolutionists. He then laughed and said, "Guess it's a little late for you. Well, you can pick it up off the wire tomorrow, about noon." I thanked him for the advance notice, and we parted. As soon as his back was turned, I sprinted to the Universe offices. You see, I already had the story. I had heard about it 2 or 3 weeks earlier, had done all my research, written it up, and then, as we had to do with all of our sensitive stories, I'd taken it to our faculty advisor. Our two faculty advisors were John Goldston and Jolyn Van Valkenburg. They, in turn, as they had to do with the very most sensitive stories, had sent Provost Bruce Hafen a memo on it explaining that they seemed to find themselves where angels fear to tread. The end result was that Hafen called and asked me to hold the story until a time when it could be better received on campus, a time when things weren't so tense. I was a team player. I sat on the story, but there was no way I was going to let Thatcher beat me on my campus. Goldston, he's an accomplished newspaper man, agreed, and he had me call Hafen, and Hafen asked if I would visit him with my story later that evening. So, at 8, I made my way across the darkened campus. Hafen met me as I entered his office. It was easy to find. He was the only one there that late. He was congenial, introducing himself and asking me about my studies and family. We both sat down, he behind his desk, and he asked me for a copy of the article. I gave it to him. He skimmed it, shook his head a couple of times, and then fished a red pen from his desk drawer. Starting at the top, he began to make marks and notations on my article. This quote won't aid the discussion, he said, striking it. And this point here will do little but stir people up, he added, drawing another red line through another passage. By the time he had finished, nearly every pro-evolution quote had been removed or had been rendered useless by heavy editing. Botanist Sam Rushforth, gone. Biologist Bill Bradshaw, gone. Zoologist Dwayne Jeffries, gone. And then Hafen handed the article back, thanked me for coming at such a late hour, and sent me on my way. I called Goldston and told him what had happened. He said he was sorry, and then he asked me to make the changes and route the article to the copy editors so we all could get some sleep. Now that I have your attention, I hope, let me just take a minute, well, it'll be more than a minute, let me take a few minutes to outline the evolution of the daily universe. I think it's a good place to start discussing the campus's historic struggle to control its student newspaper. The school's first student paper was the BYUA Student, which first appeared in 1891. It carried the mission statement that, quote, the BYUA Student will be managed exclusively by the students for the benefit of the academy and young people in general, end quote. The editors said they would take personal responsibility for anything published, adding, quote, we realize that the BYUA Student is an infant, yet it can talk, and if necessary, holler, end quote. It was replaced 5 months later by two publications, the faculty-supervised Business Journal and Normal, which in turn were succeeded after 3 years by the Journal of Pedagogy, written for both alumni and students. It only lasted 2 years. The White and Blue, a student paper along the lines of the BYUA Student, which started in 1897. It featured original reporting on campus events, carried student fiction and editorials. For example, one student column in 1903 said co-ed's grandmothers would be shocked to hear the slang their granddaughters use, such as doggone, oh lord, rubberneck. And this is the spookiest one, hot time. The paper had such mottos as character is power, and later, everyone goes to church on Sunday. That was very short-lived. At the end of one school year, the editors of White and Blue acknowledged, quote, the subject matter was not always high class, but it was true to the psychic condition of the school. The paper proved to be a mirror of our school life, end quote. In 1921, the White and Blue changed its name to Y News. Several years later, editors came out with this policy statement, quote, we will criticize wherever and whenever we deem it to be the most expedient policy, regardless of whose toes we might step on. In so doing, we will always keep in mind the best good of the institution we represent. The editors added, quote, whenever there is a difference of opinion, we will give both sides. We want this paper to be a free-for-all, end quote. It was this editorial attitude which persisted into the early 1930s that helped to instigate the paper's first major run-in with the administration. Sam Taylor, who many of you know, was an undergraduate student and a regular columnist. He frequently wrote about things one should not write about at BYU. For example, he once outlined a student bootlegging operation, providing details but no names. When the administration pressed him for sources, he refused. It was a result of such experiences and columns that resulted in at least one suspension from school and ultimately the order that Taylor be removed from the paper's staff. The Y News editor refused and, when pushed, announced, quote, under the existing situation, the only thing for me to do is resign, thus automatically removing the entire staff which I selected to work on the publication, end quote. For the rest of the year, the paper was produced by the student government and others. It was after this incident that the Faculty Publications Committee started screening candidates for the position of editor. Before a student's name could be placed on the ballot, he or she had to obtain their endorsement. In 1948, the Y News staff decided to change the paper's name to BYU Universe. A year later, BYU's publication committee began appointing editors for school publications instead of simply screening them. So you see this evolution. In 1955, the editors decided to publish 5 days a week, and shortly thereafter, the paper became the Daily Universe. It was around this time that administrators began asserting more control, not just in selecting the editor-in-chief, but over editorial content in general. For example, one time a universe editor sought to publish a map of BYU's land expansion plans, which included information on a controversial student housing project. When Benny Lewis, director of the school's auxiliary services, learned of the leak, he ordered the press's staff to remove the map, which of course prevented the paper from being distributed. An angry student editor wrote a column chastising the censorship. His piece never saw print. Lewis and a faculty advisor prohibited its publication. In protest, however, the editor allowed a blank space to run where the editorial should have been. I admire that. Incidentally, a few months later, Lewis was made a university vice president. During the next decade, the 60s, when many campus newspapers went off campus or underground, the Daily Universe stayed decidedly above ground. In fact, in early 1962, the next major universe administration confrontation occurred. Student editor Paul Richards, contrary to both publication board policy and faculty advisor council, ran an editorial endorsing a BYU student government presidential candidate. Richards, who later in his career became head of BYU Public Affairs and is now the editor of Provo Daily Herald, was called before the publications board to discuss his insubordination. Richards ended up submitting a letter of resignation, explaining, "If editorial comment is to be curtailed, there is no need for an editor. An advertising staff can publish a bulletin board." Not surprisingly, Ernest L. Wilkinson is a prominent person in this narrative. He was BYU's president for the better part of two decades, from 1951 to 1971, and he worried about the universe. He worried a lot. When the paper strayed from its prescribed path, Wilkinson heard from the general authority-led Board of Trustees. He said he disliked going to Board of Trustee meetings because he knew he'd get complaints about the universe. That pressure, in turn, was applied to faculty advisors and, to a lesser extent, student editors. That dynamic inevitably forced universe faculty advisors into roles as de facto editors-in-chief. One student editor in 1967 explained, quote, "We print anything we please and would immediately resign if anyone dared to censor us. Will you please excuse me for a couple of hours while I advisor proofreads this column prior to its publication?" End quote. One general authority who complained about the universe from time to time was Delbert L. Stapley. His letters often commented on specific offending articles and pictures, such as a picture of, quote, a girl in a prominently displayed miniskirt. Or he also was frustrated with articles on whether BYU should recruit more black athletes. On the latter topic, he asked Wilkinson, quote, "Why should we permit polls to be taken on this matter when the issue is already decided?" End quote. And a couple of years later, in January 1970, Wilkinson was involved in an undoubtedly uncomfortable situation when he had to explain to N. Eldon Tanner of the First Presidency in detail why the Daily Universe had printed the church's statement on blacks in the priesthood after he had been told twice by Tanner himself not to publish it. Wilkinson was perpetually concerned about the paper's, quote, liberal slant. Let me just break off here for a second and read you this quirky little footnote. Religious education professor Hiram Andrus was also concerned about these alleged left inclinations. Quote, "I am sure you have been aware of the liberal leanings of the Daily Universe this year," he wrote to Wilkinson. Quote, "It seems to me that particularly in periods like this one, it would be advantageous to have an intelligent young man as editor who is aware of the insidious ways of the so-called liberal element," end quote. Andrus then suggested that serious consideration be given to Paul James Toscano for that position. Incidentally, while Toscano, then a graduate student, was passed over for the Universe editorship, he was later named the editor of a new issue-centered supplement, the Monday magazine, and from what I understand, he raised all kinds of heck. Okay, back to the paper. So, like I said, Wilkinson was concerned with this liberal slant. Sometimes he even personally combated it. In 1969, he asked his assistant, Stephen R. Covey, to write responses to recent letters to the editor, and then they would find, quote, some way of getting them into the universe under some student's name, end quote. Wilkinson also enlisted the help of others, asking faculty advisor Merwin Fairbanks to, quote, stay with the paper until it goes to press every night, end quote. Obviously, this increased hands-on approach brought changes. One student editor instructed his staff to, quote, report the news, the activities, and the happenings at BYU in a manner that would be pleasing to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, our prophet David O. McKay, the general authorities of the church, our university president, Ernest Wilkinson, and the full-time staff of the university, end quote. I don't think that was really hard. And another editor was compelled to turn letters to the editor, the letters to the editor section into a question and answer column so administrators could respond directly to their critics rather than let their charges appear uncontested. Okay. Evidence of the universe's liberal slant include the publication of photos and advertisements of men with long hair and beards and women in their short skirts, occasional favorable rock concert reviews, and the discussion of ethnic issues. Here's a few typical examples. In December of 1968, the Universe printed a story discussing race issues in BYU athletics. Wilkinson was furious. Quote, the lead article today indicated that why students were in favor of recruiting Negroes. This, of course, indicated that the Negro has not been welcome, which, of course, untrue, he wrote. Wilkinson called in the student editor, Glenn Willardson, and, quote, made it quite plain, end quote, that he had lost confidence in him and told him that they would be meeting again after he had discussed the situation with the Board of Trustees. A couple of years later, a standoff with another student editor resulted in her leaving BYU for a more academic, freedom-friendly environment. In 1969, a year later, Wilkinson wrote to an advisor, quote, I was shocked to receive today yesterday's Universe, in which the first page is given over to a group with long hair and beards. Can't we avoid things of this nature, which we agreed to avoid, end quote? Apparently not. 3 days later, Wilkinson wrote, quote, I have today received the Daily Universe of Friday, September 26, in which the Ventures, with their grotesque beards and garb, are again displayed on the front page. When, oh, when are we going to get away from this? End quote. In 1971, Wilkinson expressed frustration that the Universe had been giving so much publicity to the leftists, to the quote. Okay. In 1971, Richardson expressed the frustration that the Universe had been, quote, giving so much publicity to the leftist speakers and leftist groups and the niggardly ways in which they had been treating such associations as the Young Americans for Freedom, end quote. As a result of Wilkinson's and others' missives, Lauren F. Wheelwright, Fine Arts Dean and Head of the Publications Committee, asked him to make a list of don'ts. Quote, the specific kinds of advertisements, pictures, headlines, news angles, etc. that annoy you in the Universe, end quote. He also asked Wilkinson if he wanted a university paper with a professional editor or a student-run publication with its attendant problems. Quote, now, before you fire me, let me just say that I have taken measures to improve the discipline and training of our student staff, end quote, he wrote. Quote, but all this takes time. Real progress does not come by edict. It comes by persuasion and confidence, end quote. Wilkinson responded that he did not want a professional administration edited paper, but one that follows the 13th article of faith. If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report, we seek after these things. It was a philosophy he wanted in place as soon as possible since, quote, it would be almost impossible to put it in effect with a hostile editor, end quote. As you can imagine, filling the paper with virtuous, lovely news takes time. Mistakes happen. A year later, when an article on racial prejudice in Provo ran, Wilkinson asked Wheelwright to quote, please see to it that there is a minimum of these articles and that when there are articles, they are somewhat buried in their location in the newspaper, end quote. And later, Wilkinson used harsher rhetoric, demanding that the newspaper be controlled, quote, so that we won't have any more articles that will embarrass us, end quote. Wheelwright responded that he thought students should continue to be allowed to publish their opinions, Because if administrators, quote, muzzle every student anguish and never give it a chance to be heard in the universe, they could expect it to be expressed in some other way, in an underground paper, or, heaven forbid, in a more violent form, end quote. In 1969, Wilkinson began to really push the idea that the publisher of the universe was Brigham Young University, not the students. Quote, many issues are open to complete public discussion in the daily universe. Certain issues are not proper subjects for public debate or publication in church institutions. Brigham Young University follows the direction of its trustees in identification of these issues, end quote. Wilkinson explained, Wilkinson also added, quote, the daily universe shall print the truth or remain silent, end quote. Over the next few years, the paper compiled a list of topics considered too controversial for publication. These included Negro and the priesthood and other racial problems, polygamy, sex education, pornography, nudity, personal stories on church leaders involving age, health, children, etc., confidential church and university information such as finances, appointments, council meetings, ecclesiastical tribunals, embarrassing incidents, both historical and current, attacks on church and BYU policies, church policies regarding the war in Vietnam, university policies regarding standards, etc., evolution and claims of sciences in conflict with beliefs in church leaders, church censorship such as involving Jesus Christ Superstar, and acid rock music, nude painting, etc. The first presidency, always concerned about BYU's standing in the larger academic community, cautioned Wilkinson in 1972 not to do anything, quote, in the management of the daily universe or say anything which could be misinterpreted as an improper suppression of student thought and attitudes, end quote. Our concern in this matter, the letter continued, is that, quote, nothing be done which would jeopardize the good standing of the university as a result of inquiries made by the accreditation teams, which periodically check into conditions on campus, end quote. A few years earlier, President Tanner had suggested that the universe print both sides of a controversy so no one could cry censorship. Wilkinson himself understood that point, commenting once, quote, of course, when we tell the students flatly they cannot publish something, they say they do not have freedom of speech, and they are unfortunately backed up by the accreditation committee, so we are still groping for a solution, end quote. In 1972 was a pivotal year in terms of universe organization. As it turned out, it was the new president, Dallin Oaks, not Wilkinson, who finally oversaw the formal transference of the paper from student jurisdiction to the communications department. The chair of the communications department was also named publisher at this time. Faculty were given positions of executive editor, business manager, photography editor, and later editorial page director. Working at the universe went from an extracurricular activity to a requirement for all journalism majors. And incidentally, the paper was changed from a tabloid size to a broadsheet. That's a dumb fact. While the reorganization improved the technical quality of the paper substantially, it did not come without problems. In 1973, 14 student journalists signed and sent a letter to Oaks and the local media complaining that the control the news attitude of their superiors had squelched several recent stories. Oaks was angered by the letter's release to the press, calling it, quote, a breach of professional ethics and a violation of personal trust, end quote. 7 years later, history repeated itself. This time, 12 editors wrote of the, quote, paternalistic attitude which precludes student participation in decisions which virtually affect them, end quote. They further protested that the communications faculty feared, quote, administrative retribution, adopting an inconsistent policy of teaching freedom of the press in the classroom and censoring it in the newsroom, end quote. Oaks responded that he had a policy of not communicating with members of the university community through the pages of any newspaper. What had already been published in the public press on that issue is the only formal reply you will receive on the subject, end quote. That was Oaks. While the question and answer format of the letters to the editor section didn't last, a policy of having faculty advisors check sensitive letters to the editor had been instituted. Then, in 1977, a letter that discussed the university's new but announced no beard policy embarrassed President Oakes, and yet another layer of faculty review was added, making it such that all letters to the editor were read prior to publication. Of course, Oakes, like other presidents, received his share of pressure from the Board of Trustees. For example, in 1979, Boyd K. Packer wrote, quote, "I have three articles in the last few weeks that I think may be somewhat out of spirit with what might represent the editorial policy of a university operated by the church. Is something happening to the universe? Does not a paper have an editorial policy?" End quote. Okay, at this point, I need to tell you that notwithstanding the history that I just outlined, the universe, especially when you compare it to other student-run publications at other universities, is pretty good. It's quite good. Let me offer you some evidence. It consistently wins regional and national awards from organizations such as the Society of Professional Journalists. Over the years, it has published a number of significant in-depth investigative reports and intelligent opinion pieces. For example, in 1979, reporters exposed BYU Food Services for serving flavored turkey billed as ham, bologna, and hot dogs. From what I understand, 60 Minutes was all over that right afterwards. And wait a minute. The controversy deepens. They were also adding ground turkey to the hamburger as an extender. I'm not kidding. Okay, I should also note that the universe has not always been void of humor, like our evil stepsister, the Student Review, would have you believe. In a parody of itself, in 1979, the Unifarce, which the Student Review stole from the Daily Universe, thinking they were all so clever, editors advertised the new BYU-published book, Free Agency and How to Enforce It. I've got a copy if anyone would like to borrow it. More recently, in a freshman orientation edition, the universe ran a list of ways to tell you have a deadbeat date, including, she thinks Rex E. Lee is a Civil War general, and he picks you up and then proceeds to pick up three other women and then explains to you that you are on a polygamy date. While strong investigative reporting and editorials have come and gone, two luminaries on the reportorial side are Vern Anderson, who's with the Associated Press, and Dale Van Atta, who many of you know. The universe has had a fairly consistent record with editorial cartoonists. Starting as early as the late 1960s, illustrators such as Kurt Hanks were commenting on topics writers couldn't or wouldn't deal with. One such cartoon portrayed a BYU security officer taking notes from a ragged student, partially buried by rocks, explaining, and then I said, those of you without sin should cast the first stone. Cal Grondo later gave that wider publication when he redid it. Very good. The late 70s and early 80s produced first-rate talent such as Pat Bagley, now with the Salt Lake Tribune, Calvin Grondahl, now with the Ogden Standard Examiner, and the Pulitzer Prize winner Steve Benson, now with the Arizona Republic. The most notable star to emerge from the universe over the last few years is the well-decorated John DeRosier, who is now with the Mobile Press Register in Alabama. Okay, that doesn't quite bring us up into the 90s, but you get the idea. What I want to talk about now is my experience and understanding of the universe. While some of the early 70s structural changes at the universe remain, the business manager is still a faculty member, the paper still falls under the jurisdiction of the communications department, BYU, not the students, is still listed as publisher, there are important differences. One is that reporter positions are almost exclusively filled by public relations and journalism students. Participation is a graduation requirement. Another difference is that, and I should note that I think this is a disaster, because you get a bunch of students in there, especially public relations students, who don't want to do it. They're just trying to fill their three articles in a week and get out, and that's where a lot of lousy stuff gets run in the universe. Another difference is that all editorial positions are now staffed by students. Editor-in-chief, photo editor, managing editor, even night editor, whose main responsibility as final gatekeeper is to alert the faculty advisor of potentially disastrous articles. At the same time, there is still no student input in the selection of universe editors-in-chief. They are selected by faculty advisors. There's John Goldston. He's a veteran newspaper man, and Jolene Van Valkenburg, a longtime copy editor for the Church-owned Deseret News. So they're really good. They're They're good for the job. The rest of the staff is selected with some advisor guidance by the editor. Student editors really do run the paper. They decide articles they want to publish. They assign them out. They follow them up. They decide which articles are junk and won't run. They decide how much space to devote to an event or issue, whether it will run on the first page or buried, if art will accompany it. One of the two main faculty advisors does sit in on the daily editorial meeting, but their comments usually go something like, "Hey, this Bosnia thing is kind of a big deal. You probably ought to run something on it." And sadly, much of the critique that these advisors offer to the Daily Universe centers on layout, headlines, and copy editing. The Universe staff could use a lot more issue-centered discussion. Honestly, the bulk of the censorship of the Universe is self-censorship. Most editors know what will and will not fly. They know that a stack of universes are delivered daily to the church office building and that they are read. With this in mind, Universe employees work to position the paper as a product of a church-owned school by running student scriptures of the day, extensive covering of on-campus general authority talks, and printing special general conference editions with full-color photos. Also, on a pragmatic level, journalism students quickly realize two things. One, the only way to get a job in a very tight journalism market is to produce at the Daily Universe. And two, the Universe is a pretty good-paying job. It's one of the top five on campus, and you don't want to lose that. Okay, let's talk. How much time do I have? A minute? 5 minutes? Okay. Let's talk about the relatively infrequent incidences of censorship that do come from advisors, administrators, and the Board of Trustees. While I was told at the beginning of my editorship that we don't touch four areas, attacks on the brethren, homosexuality, evolution, and things that go against church doctrine or policy, my experience is that most advisor censorship comes as a result of pressure from other university power centers. The head of BYU's physical plant places a call after he learns of an article investigating the amount of on-the-clock time the average flower gardener spends at the Kukurit. Or a library official sends a memo after being interviewed for an article on BYU's collection of pornographic books and magazines. Or an administrator at the campus dairy calls the university president, who calls an advisor when a reporter starts asking about an internal memo on a current salmonella problem. These are all actual examples. And sometimes the pressure comes directly from the top. One faculty advisor received a phone mail message from a top university official that warned him to be careful in the paper's coverage of a certain issue. Quote, "This could be harmful for the university, your students, and you," he said. Administration and Board of Trustees meddling, in my experience, is even rarer. I previously mentioned my evening with Bruce Hafen, who, incidentally, later denied the whole experience ever happened in an editor and publisher article. To my knowledge, that kind of hands-on experience is unique. But other, perhaps equally potent, situations have occurred. Here's a couple of examples. Sometimes the Universe staff creates an environment that almost begs for a censoring call from the administration. During the Far Knowlton firings, I was a reporter under Tad Walsh, an ambitious, competent editor. He was committed to comprehensive issued center reporting during these chaotic, intense times. One day, we placed four important stories on the front page: a student protest, a student protesting the protest, a report of an off-campus forum on academic freedom that featured a former BYU student, Joanna Brooks, who announced that she was giving back her diploma, and coverage of an on-campus presentation by Margaret Toscano that discussed Mother in Heaven. Within hours of the issue's release, Universe editors heard from an advisor that at least one Board of Trustee member had called President Rex Lee to ask, one, what the heck is going on at your university, and two, why are we giving it all such high-profile coverage in our newspaper? A couple of days later, I wrote a story comparing the publishing records of Farr and Knowlton with other faculty members who had passed their third-year reviews. Inadequate scholarship was the reason BYU had given for their dismissals. I should have been more savvy. When I called BYU spokesperson Margaret Smoot for response, she told me to hang on. She'd get back to me. A couple of hours later, she called and told me not to run the article. It would be in the university's best interest, she said. Elaborating, she said that anything printed in the Universe could be used against BYU in future appeals or lawsuits filed by Farr and Knowlton. I still don't know if that's true, but I do know that my article never ran. A few months later, in October 1993, many of you might remember... Another minute? Cut this off? Okay. A few months later, in October 1993, many of you might remember seeing a spate of Associated Press articles where Steve Benson accused Elder Dallin Oaks of dissembling to the press about general authority involvement in the 1993 excommunications of Abraham Gileadi, Paul Toscano, Maxine Hanks, Levina Fielding Anderson, Michael Quinn, and the discipline of Lynn Whitesides. As the editor that semester, after covering the Far Nolton stuff, I was trying to be on my best behavior. So we self-censored the story, until an advisor was told that Elder Oaks wanted the universe to run his response to Benson's allegations. We did it with no context, no editor's note. When the AP carried Benson's rejoinder, we did nothing with it. A few points as I wrap up. First, the universe has done some good investigative reporting and editorializing over the last few years, sometimes with the help of university administrators and the church. When Brian Evanson was compelled to leave the university over his freedom to write violent, difficult fiction, Universe editors commented, quote, "The fact that a piece of literature is hard to digest should not make it unworthy of study. Plenty of scriptural stories are graphic in their portrayals of violent behavior. Are we going to excise those passages from study, too?" The Universe broke the story that, another example, the Universe broke the story that because of honor code violations, the BYU men's volleyball team had to withdraw from a meet in Japan. Because both the head coach and school administrators gave quotes and were very helpful. The Universe was the first to report that the university had approved the creation of a women's resource center. And that only happened because BYU spokesperson Margaret Smoot called us early with the story. Okay, my second point is that if you were to pull half a dozen former Universe editors, you would probably get just as many different takes on these issues. For example, Stephen Parkins, an editor-in-chief in 1995, in a letter to the Salt Lake Tribune, said that during his tenure, his staff was, quote, under constant pressure to withhold information or prejudice the truth in favor of university administrators. Yet we were tenacious enough, he added, to raise issues that the administration would rather bury and do so fairly and accurately. End quote. Okay, so where's the universe headed? Well, if last year's self-study committee had had their way, it would now be under control of the university president's office. Goldston said he was stunned by the recommendation. After all, just a few years earlier, an ad hoc committee had studied the paper and had found it to have proper, quote, proper goals and be headed in the right direction. I pretty much agree with that statement, largely because I accept that, yes, there is censorship of the Daily Universe. Two, censorship, while distasteful, is understandable. Faculty advisors have families to feed. Bruce Hafen, in addition to having a family, had a board of general authorities he reported to and is loyal to. Three, censorship is not unique to BYU or other student papers. Every news organization has editors, publishers, and publics with strong opinions and biases that inevitably find their way into the copy. My one complaint is that when student journalists, especially in a lab environment such as the Daily Universe, aren't engaged in dialogue on these important issues that precipitate censorship, everyone loses. Goldston's vision for the paper is, quote, "We're trying to leaven the loaf here by making a difference in the community at the same time that we're creating solid, reputable journalists with high moral standards." That's definitely a tall order, and it might even be doable.
Until the last 2 seconds of my talk, and so I'm going to send it around now, and that way you can look at it, and then I'll kind of tell you a little more about it. If you were to enroll at BYU today, or if your children were to do the same, then they might come across this, which is an honors code referral card, which is something that they could use to wrap on their friends if their friend had a secret earring that they took out and was mail when they went to class, so they could mark the earring box and put it in campus mail and send it. So I'll talk about that at the very end. The bulk of my paper is actually about an earlier part of this history that I'm writing in this chapter of our book. If you don't know, Brian and I have been writing a book together for the last 3 years. We were both students at BYU when we started working on it, and we had never met, although we knew. I was in charge of student review. He was in charge of the Daily Universe. I knew who he was. I didn't trust him, and I didn't know him. And one of my teachers and a close friend told me, "You really should get to meet this guy. He's going to write a book about BYU and all this academic freedom stuff." And I said, "You're kidding." I said, "That's terrible." And he said, "No, Brian's really cool. You would really like him." So, and I had been amassing like all of this stuff that I wanted to write a book about academic freedom at BYU. So actually we met and we decided to write the book together. So we've been working on it slowly because we live in different places and it's hard to do this work while we're in school, but it's coming along. And sessions like this that we keep doing together, that some of you I keep recognizing, keep coming to our sessions, are helping us make progress on that book, which we hope to have done before, I don't know, before the second coming. So I should say, too, that I also appreciate the help that Gary and Ron have been able to give us, including a lot of encouragement to really go through with this project and finish this book, and I appreciate that a lot. I'm going to tell a little true story, too, that sort of like the one that Brian told at the beginning of his. I think it was the fall of 1993. I was starting my last year at BYU. I think I might have been the publisher of Student Review. I don't exactly remember. That sort of sounds right. And the campus Democrats were having a conference on tolerance or in diversity or something like that, the kind of thing that campus Democrats are the only ones who do at BYU. And they asked me to give a talk at their thing. And I guess because of editorials I'd written or something from the Student Review, or they just wanted to appreciate Student Review's diversity, and they were genuinely nice people. And so at that point, my hair was about as long as it could get and still get away with it at BYU. And I still had, on occasion, people tell me that my hair was too long or that I hadn't shaved that morning, and my standard answer was, well, I'm just trying to be like Jesus. But in order to get approval for me as a speaker, they had to go to the head of the BYUSA, their advisor, and I had to have an interview with him, and they had to talk to me about the content of my speech, and they didn't trust me because I worked for Student Review. And so to get ready to go in for this talk, I went and cut my hair. I can't believe I did it. I gave in. I went with this guy from Campus Democrats. We went and got our hair cut together. It was the shortest haircut I had had since I'd been on my mission. So I haven't cut my haircut since. It was so traumatic. It was so good. And so, at the end of this story, I'm going to say, in a couple weeks I'm going to cut my hair, but in honor of the 3 years of fighting back against that kind of oppression, I'm going to let my hair down while I read this talk. So, and I really want to do this. Okay. And I usually don't wear it down, so. Okay. A little bit of introduction for my paper. My topic is so huge, the history of the honor code at BYU. It's one introductory chapter of four introductory chapters to the book, that I'm only going to read a small slice of the chronology of this history. Okay, in 1993, Carl Sandburg, who's at the symposium, I don't think he's in the room. Carl Sandburg, who's a visiting professor of humanities at BYU, he had retired at McAllister College in Minnesota, wrote an essay for Student Review, which I asked him to write, and I'm very happy that I did, recalling his years as a student at BYU in the 1950s, imagining himself as Rip Van Sandburg, falling asleep on the Mazur lawn as a student and waking up 45 years later. He used this conceit to map the changes he had observed in BYU's intellectual and social geography. What appears to me to be the biggest change at BYU, he concluded, is a loss of confidence. His main illustration of this point regarded the university's honor code. When the honor code was established in the 1950s, he wrote, it applied to academic work and could be stated very simply. The students agreed not to cheat, and the faculty agreed not to snoop. It worked well. Honor could only arise from within, which was a quote that turns up again and again in the material from this period. He observed a general obsession in the church, this is his quote, with control, and the effect of that control seems to be nothing so much as the ghettoization of Mormon intellectual and social life. So I've thought a lot about this article since he wrote it, and in doing the research for this article, I've found that in most aspects, the documents bear out his observations. The story of BYU's honor code in the half century after its inception is one of continuing control exerted over students and faculty by the school's administration and board. The lack of confidence Sandburg described can alternately be read as a panic very much still in force, although it was initially rooted firmly in the conservative social panic of the 1960s. As in many other areas, BYU's current understanding of its honor code and, like I said, outline the development of honor code and dress and grooming standards from the period of 1967 to 1972 and tell you why I think those years were absolutely crucial in setting a trajectory that has never finished. We're still on it at BYU. And so I'll kind of give you that and my interpretation of this history at the end. Okay, in the 20 years Wilkinson oversaw BYU, the university size increased exponentially. By the end of the 1960s, the university was turning away worthy applicants, according to Dean of Students J. Elliott Cameron, by the thousands. The growth meant increasing difficulty for the administration in monitoring and disciplining students. Under a small administration, they could get to know students, and the Dean of Women would interview every woman student every semester, and the Dean of Students would see, and they knew all of the students, they knew who was having problems, who missed their mom, and who, you know, whose roommate wasn't doing the fair share of cooking. But when Wilkinson expanded this campus incredibly, and the population of the student body increased by six to around 25,000, there's no way they could monitor the student population personally. So Wilkinson was the chief force behind university expansion. His humble goal was to create the best university in the world, but he was also the chief force behind an increasing impulse to control and direct not only academic and political life for faculty, but social life for students as well. Wilkinson oversaw, especially during the 1960s, aspects of student life as minute as what music could be played on campus, what dances could be danced, what movies could be shown, even in off-campus theaters. And perhaps receiving the greatest attention, he wanted to dictate what clothes could be worn and what hairstyles men especially could sport. In the years leading up to his retirement in 1971, Wilkinson transformed the honor code's focus from cheating, as Sandberg correctly recalled its initial focus, to sexual behavior and substance abuse. He institutionalized regulation for dress and grooming, and he created the rubric of university standards, which subsumed and conflated honor and dress until a student's outward appearance became the chief indicator of her or his moral character and suitability for attendance at the university. The confusion surrounding these categories, honor, dress, and standards, persists today. As Gary Bergera and Ron Prittis aptly demonstrated in their very fun 1985 book, Brigham Young University, A House of Faith, which I think you can find on some of the youth book tables out there, much of Wilkinson's paranoia about control of academic and social life was motivated by his firm opposition to what he perceived as the nation's weakening moral fiber and the liberalization of American university life. And I didn't live through this, and I mean, I grant him a lot of leeway here. I imagine it was a scary time. A firm believer in Cold War conservatism, Wilkinson recoiled from the increasing social liberalism and the flamboyant youth culture he saw on other campuses. Many of his policies and proposals throughout the decade were framed as much in opposition to what he observed on other American campuses as they were to what was happening in Provo. For example, in a much-quoted address delivered in 1965, he warned that he did not want on campus any beatniks, buzzards, or beetles. And sure enough, he spent the rest of the decade pursuing any traces of the youth counterculture that might try to bring their sandals and ragged Levi's to BYU. By 1967, when the anti-war movement was swinging into full force on other campuses, Wilkinson was prepared to enforce a more stringent honor code for faculty and students in response. A major issue for Wilkinson was the use of narcotics, which he associated chiefly with the counterculture and with communism and with everything. It's all tied together. He also was concerned about church activity among students and requested in April of 1967 information from campus bishops regarding the church activity of their ward members. A certain amount of tension existed between a faction led by Wilkinson, which believed that students who were not living church and school standards should be removed to make way for more worthy students, and others, represented, for example, by English professor Doug Thayer, who felt that no information given to a bishop in confession should be able to jeopardize student standing. For the time being, Thayer's faction won the board's support, although today Wilkinson's dream is played out in full force. In November 1967 saw revisions to the honor code related to drug use. While a passing reference to cheating and honesty remained, the bulk of the new honor code referred to standards of sexual purity and prohibitions against drug use or other violations of the word of wisdom. These provisions, the code explained, were necessary if BYU was to fill its role as, quote, an ensign of proper conduct to the entire world, close quote. On the 4th of December, 1967, a Universe article explained that if a student has been reported to the standards office and the accusation is denied, the person making the charges is requested to supply proof. There is always an avenue for escape for a person who has been accused wrongly, even though the evidence against him is convincing. This is the polygraph, or lie detector test,
which is administered by Captain Sven C. Nielsen of Security. While the test, which is given on a strictly voluntary basis, would not be admitted as evidence in a courtroom, it is accepted by BYU, close quote. That month, a revision to the university handbook placed faculty under the same honor code that students had just been placed under, which caused a furor at the end of the semester faculty meeting. And Gary and Ron in their book talk about how this furor was so strong that Bob Thomas, who's the administrator who's in charge, just closed it down, and he said he was never going to conduct a faculty meeting again. He just had somebody say the prayer and get out of here. But teachers were furious at the idea that they would have to be placed under this honor code, which is really similar to what happened in the last year or two when BYU professors have been informed again that they have to meet they have to have a temple recommend or they could be fired. And it's so insulting in a lot of ways. That's how a lot of them feel. They feel like their honor is worthless because someone has to check on them. And that's exactly how the faculty felt in 1968. In February 1968, Wilkinson issued a statement that students arrested on drug charges would be automatically suspended. A lot of this was new territory for the university. Dean Cameron explained in the universe that arrest in and of itself would constitute enough evidence to warrant suspension. Apparently the policy was devised post facto after BYU security had posed as drug dealers and arrested five students who were willing to buy pot. The action was referred to by a lawyer for the students as incorporating Gestapo tactics. A letter to the universe held that someone should inform Dean Cameron that the present year is 1968 and not 1984. The episode and others like it helped students realize that they had lost control of honor code enforcement. In the spring of 1968, students repeatedly complained in the Daily Universe and elsewhere that a new version of the honor code, drafted by an administrative committee, had never been proposed to or accepted by the student body. And this was a situation where that was upsetting to them. I just say, oh. They changed the honor code. Somebody changed it. I mean, I would never think that students could have this autonomy, but they felt upset that this happened. The old adage of honor from within was clearly shifting to enforcement from without. Students debated whether the new code applied to all students or only to those who had entered the school after its inception. A Universe editorial on 29 April 1968 stated that although we don't believe it is the case, it looks like the administration is trying to pull something over on the student body. The following day, in a Universe article entitled Honor Code Explained, Tag Taggart, chair of the Student Honor Council, explained that all students were to be held accountable to the new code. I must emphasize, however, he added, that it's not because that's what the Student Honor Council wants, but rather because that's what the administration wants. All of the leaders of the Student Honor Council were thoroughly frustrated that they had lost control over the honor code. That May, Wilkinson wanted to change residence hall's contracts to allow for increased access by the administration to search for drugs. This was in response, Wilkinson explained, to the increase in marijuana troubles experienced on campus during the previous year. Again, however, he was also attempting to formulate rules in response to national trends. We do not want to become inundated with drugs, as some universities have been. The proposed change was simply an attempt to preserve BYU standards, in his words. Student faculty, and eventually board opposition won out, and the new clause was not adopted. I'm trying to think of this source. Harris was upset with this proposed change to the code. He was afraid that it would cause legal problems if Wilkinson just had open access to student property and could seize anything he wanted, whatever. Also in May of 1968, however, an even more extensive code of student conduct was drafted by a committee of administrators and students together and was adopted as policy. The new code outlined 15 points, the violation of any of which could result in expulsion or suspension. The code also encouraged students to report violations, just similar to what is happening right now. The 15 points included cheating, but the overwhelming majority were designed to counter trends on other campuses and included prohibitions on premarital sex, drug use, and other substances prohibited by the Word of Wisdom, as well as other activities that were more directly related to anti-war protests and hadn't been included in the other new honor code that they used briefly and got rid of. such as obstruction or disruption of university activities, violation of university policies concerning student organizations, disorderly conduct, and failure to comply with directions of university officials. Seems like these things were added to the honor code clearly to try to defeat whatever anti-war sentiment might be present on campus. When students returned to campus that fall, the new code was not accepted without dissent. The chair of the ASBYU Honor Council declared in protest that there is no longer a real honor code at BYU because individual honor had seemingly been written out of the new, more detailed code. Some faculty concurred. "Personally, I feel deeply ashamed for BYU," wrote geology professor Jess Bushman, "because there was not enough faith in the integrity of the students to allow them to manage their own honor program." Dean Elliot Cameron responded to this discussion that although students no longer had direct control over the honor code, which previously had been called the student honor code, it was still an effective measure of honor because students were required to sign it and abide by it and thereby test their integrity. Later that month, Wilkinson was incensed by a universe photo of three bearded professors. This is where Brian and I overlap. After he had forced these professors to shave, an upset student wrote to the newspaper sounding board, which was the column for question and answers that Brian talked about, I think. The one called sounding board? Or is that an early incarnation? I think those are the student writing responses, actually. And he wanted to know why Kurt Weinzinger, Mal Mabee, and Paul Forster were invited to remove their beards. What type of pressure was applied? The paper's response was, "Kurt Weinzinger indicated a short talk with the dean of his college was held concerning the matter. From his comments, it seems the Board of Trustees requested faculty members not wear beards. Kurt also indicated he was in a hurry and didn't ask about the consequences for noncompliance." Paul Forster indicated the request centered around the faculty image to be set for certain students at the university. About pressure, he said there was absolutely none, and Mal Mabee declined to comment. In a 4 September meeting with the Board of Trustees, Wilkinson received instruction that every effort was to be undertaken by the administration to eliminate the wearing of miniskirts and to encourage male students not to wear beards or long hair. In a 22 October meeting, a month and a half later, between Wilkinson and administrators, it was decided that students who sold marijuana would be terminated immediately, no questions asked. The only group of people to receive that kind of sanction previously, immediate expulsion for their violation, were gays or people who participated in homosexual behavior, and that was a policy that was instituted in the late 50s. We still have under consideration, Wilkinson wrote following the meeting,